This agreement represents our collective vision to a sustainable economy in our villages.
A deal between Shell Oil and North Slope Corporations. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, investigating a whale strike near Kodiak.
This animal definitely died from a massive trauma. It got hit. It got T-boned, basically.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and a handful of North Slope Village corporations now have the option to buy into offshore drilling operations in the Chukchi Sea. It's part of a new agreement with Shell Oil, but with the future of that company's Arctic operations up in the air, the deal raises more questions than answers. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
Arctic Inupiat Offshore is the new company that's formed as a potential partner in Shell's Chukchi Sea operations. Six village corporations from across the North Slope have a stake in it, as well as the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, one of the biggest locally held companies in Alaska. Rex Rock leads the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and he's been named the president of the new company. He took the stage at a press conference Thursday to announce its launch in Anchorage.
This agreement that represents our collective vision and commitment to a sustainable economy in our villages.
The details of the agreement are still fuzzy. Arctic Inupiat Offshore will have the option to invest in Shell Oil's operations in the Chukchi Sea and get a cut of revenue back in the form of royalties. But Shell's Chukchi Sea operations have been on hold for 2 years now. This spring, a federal court upheld a challenge to Shell's leases there. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is in the middle of an environmental reassessment, which will determine whether the government was right to let Shell buy $2 billion in leases in the Chukchi back in 2008. Shell's CEO, Ben Van Beurden, discussed some of those uncertainties during a conference call with reporters on Thursday morning. He said development's inevitable in the Arctic, and Shell is still interested in being a part of it when the time is right.
We will only do it when all the conditions are fulfilled. All the technical conditions, as well as all the permit conditions, as well as, of course, the legal challenges and blockages that need to be removed. When that will be, I don't know. It is impossible to say at this stage.
For Van Beurden, that's a pretty optimistic take on Arctic exploration. The CEO has openly questioned whether Shell's almost $6 billion investment in the Arctic is worth it since he took over back in January. His position doesn't come as a surprise to Susan Murray. She's a deputy vice president for the environmental group Oceana.
So until the time that they decide that these leases are not something worth pursuing, I think that he has to say we are looking at what we would do with this asset that we've acquired.
Murray's skeptical in part because of a recent study that Oceana conducted. The group reviewed oil and gas holdings in the Beaufort Sea and found that six companies have let their offshore leases lapse. Shell looks to be the only major player left. That definitely wasn't the focus of Thursday's press conference in Anchorage to announce Shell's partnership with Arctic Inupiat Offshore. The message was that stakeholders would have a greater say in Arctic oil development in their backyards and the opportunity to profit. Shell Vice President Pete Slaby brushed aside concerns that his company might be thinking about pulling back from the Arctic.
This is about Shell working with AIO and getting some extremely knowledgeable and savvy business partners, nothing more than that.
What's not clear is what AIO will get in return, how big a stake shareholders could eventually have in the Chukchi Sea, and whether it will pay off. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal with help from Liz Ruskin in Anchorage.
For more about the agreement between Shell and the North Slope Corporations, we have APRN's Liz Ruskin, who was at the Anchorage press conference announcing the deal today. Liz, how important is this announcement?
Hi, Lori. It's hard to say. ASRC President Rex Rock and Shell executive Pete Slaby took a few questions from reporters, but said the specifics of the deal were proprietary. So we don't know, for instance, whether the native corporations paid to have these lease options, how long they have to exercise them, and whether they can obtain a substantial share of the leases or not.
What do we know?
We know that ASRC and the six North Slope Village corporations have formed this new entity called Arctic Inupiat Offshore, and we know AIO and Shell have an agreement that allows AIO an option to acquire an interest in Shell's Chukchi leases, all 275 of them, according to Slaby. The option agreement says AIO would have an overriding royalty interest in the oil and gas, if it's ever produced, of course. And according to the press release announcing the deal, they'd also have an option to acquire a working interest if and when Shell commits to developing the leases. They wouldn't say what any of that means specifically.
Does this seem to be, is this a realignment of North Slope politics?
Not really. These village corporations, for the most part, already sided with Shell in favor of offshore development, and many had big contracts with the industry. But outside the corporations, offshore development does remain controversial on the North Slope. Whalers and other subsistence users will often tell you they fear oil development will upset the whale migration and harm other populations that they depend on. And at the press conference today, Rex Rock said repeatedly that this will give AIO a seat at the table with Shell, suggesting they'd have some say in what happens. Rock also said it would allow North Slope communities to share in the benefits of offshore development to help balance out the risks they face. And Rock pointed out that he himself is a whaling captain.
So what do you think this reveals? What does it say about Shell's commitment to develop its offshore leases?
That's debatable, depending on what you think Shell's intentions are. This could be the start of Shell backing away from the Arctic, or it could be its way of securing more buy-in from the local communities to make development more palatable. It could have very little effect if no money changes hands and the options are never exercised. They said so little about the deal that ultimately we don't know much. They did say they'd been working on the deal for about 4 years, and Rock made a point of saying the corporations approached Shell and Shell didn't initiate it.
All right. Well, thanks for helping us understand this a little bit better, Liz.
Thank you, Lori.
That was APRN's Liz Ruskin reporting from Anchorage. A vocal show of frustration from Nome's mining community took center stage at this week's city council meeting. The miners were angry about a letter the city sent to the State Department of Natural Resources complaining about impacts from the recent gold mining boom. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports from Nome.
During public comments, there were remarks on two new liquor license applications, as well as concerns over Nome's worsening muskox problems. But for about an hour, the only comments came from gold miners.
We're feeling like you're throwing rocks at us the way some of this is written.
Kenny Hughes is with Nome's chapter of the Alaska Mining Association. He and others were angry about language in a letter City Manager Josie Banky sent earlier this month outlining the financial and social burden Nome has experienced since the 2011 Department of Natural Resources lease sale helped open up the current offshore dredging boom. The sale brought in millions in revenues for the state, but left Nome without the money to accommodate increased port activity. Banky says that put the city on the hook for new costs, everything from hiring extra employees to setting up facilities for human waste.
We are a mining town, you know, but we haven't heard anything from DNR since June, and that's been frustrating. We've sat down, we've told them over and over what our concerns are, and there's never any follow-up that's been done. You know, I apologize for any negative connotations in there, but it's more or less, I guess, in response to the frustration with no response.
Many of the speakers also felt left out for not being notified of the letter or being included in more formal dialogues. Several had printed copies of the letter with them, reading from it at the podium. Homer resident Vern Atkinson owns a dredging operation and is compensated by the Discovery Channel for appearing on the Bering Sea Gold franchise. He and others repeatedly raised the point the gold sector brings an economic boom to Nome.
I'm an American, you know, and when I come to Nome, I'm a citizen of Nome. I got just as many rights as anybody else around here. Okay, I'm not taking a back seat to anybody. I don't care if they, when I come here, I cover all the ground I stand on, you know? And I don't like being put down and because I'm up here mining and you people are sharing in the benefits of it.
The extent of that economic benefit is debatable. While the mining sector brings in money for some businesses, Councilmember Stan Anderson says municipal entities like the port, roads, city services don't get much of those revenues. Anderson pegged the figure at around just 5%. The matter became heated when miners pushed for the city to define what was meant in the letter by negative social impacts. Mayor Denise Michaels offered several examples, like the rise in methamphetamine and heroin use.
So don't laugh at this. This is a really serious issue. And if you don't know the use, what a heroin user looks like or does, it goes right under your nose. So those are some of the social issues that are happening in Nome.
Not because of gold.
No, because gold? Of, no, not gold? The gold problem, but these okay. are new social issues that came up.
Bob Hafner, a longtime Nome resident and miner, was one of the few voices insisting neither side is doing enough to accommodate the other's needs.
My kids are native. I want them to be able to subsist. I want them to be able to go down to Belmont Point and fish. By golly, we don't have to have all our dredges sitting right on shore. Y'all got boats. We need to make some room too, guys. It's not just them. We need to make some accommodations too, and we're not communicating.
But almost everyone that came for public comment left once it ended, leaving chambers sparse even as the council moved into discussing a seasonal tax that would have raised revenues for summer sectors, like mining. The council ultimately voted not to bring that seasonal tax to voters. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a young and very persistent violinist in Juneau.
I kept asking my mom, and she said, fine, I'll call the teacher and see.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at crowleyalaska.com.
National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration law enforcement officials are investigating a collision between the state ferry Kennecott and a humpback whale near Kodiak. The incident brought a multi-agency team of scientists to the island to help determine whether the collision caused the death of the subadult humpback whale. KMXT's Brianna Gibbs has more.
Kate Wynn is a marine mammal specialist for the University of Alaska Sea Grant Program and spent all of Wednesday cutting open the 25-ton humpback whale, which is currently beached on Puffin Island, just beyond Kodiak Harbor's breakwater.
This animal definitely died from a massive trauma. It got hit. It got T-boned, basically, in a characteristic way that ship strikes have been evidenced before.
The lead vet for the investigation was Frances Gulland, a senior scientist at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California. She flew up to Kodiak on Tuesday and spent more than 7 hours performing a full-body internal examination on the carcass.
The most dramatic finding was just massive fractures of the skull. She had multiple fractures, both on the right side and the left side of the skull, and a lot of hemorrhage. So she must have died instantly when she was hit on the back of her head.
Gulland said it's pretty clear the whale was hit while it was alive, but whether or not that fatal blow was caused by a ship, specifically the ferry Kennecott, is still unknown. The determination is now up to NOAA law enforcement, which will look at a variety of factors to try and pinpoint what actually killed the whale. Wynn said her understanding was that the whale strike was actually reported by Kennecott crew members, who notified officials that they hit something, but no whales were visible, so they weren't sure if that was what occurred.
And when they got to port, they looked over as they slowed down. They saw the whale was on the bow of the ship, and it slid off as they slowed down, and there's no water pushing against it. So they hit a whale, but the question was it a dead whale when they hit it or a live whale when they hit it? In either case, reporting it was the absolute best thing for them to do immediately.
Wynn said whale and ship collisions are an interesting conservation problem worldwide, especially in areas with larger, high-traffic shipping lanes. She said research is being done to determine what speeds might be safe for ships to travel and avoid fatal collisions, as well as monitoring whale distributions. In Kodiak, I'm Brianna Gibbs.
Rural communities in northeastern Alaska could be left without caribou in the future. That's according to a recent study. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, scientists believe climate change could increase wildfire potential in lichen-rich boreal forest, where the central Arctic and porcupine caribou herds forage in the winter.
University of Alaska Fairbanks Assistant Wildlife Biology Professor Todd Brinkman recently co-authored a study with scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey that shows caribou herds in Alaska's northeast could lose 21% of their winter habitat in the near future.
They are very migratory, almost semi-nomadic in some sense. So them moving all over their massive range isn't anything new. The new thing with this study is that the proportion of high-quality winter habitat is anticipated to decline over the next century.
The study looks closely at the effects of predicted increasing temperatures and how that might influence the flammability of the forest in northeastern Alaska and northwestern Canada. Brinkman says the findings don't really surprise him.
Well, not super surprised. I think we know that with increasing temperatures in the Arctic, there's likely going to be more wildfires, maybe higher severity, more frequent. But what was kind of novel about this work is that we were able to better quantify the extent that the boreal forest may be affected.
Brinkman says changes in caribou distribution in the winter means residents in places like Arctic Village and Old Crow in Canada's Yukon will have to become more flexible.
A lot of these climate drivers are kind of out of local control. So what this study or how this study might be of value to locals is that they can start to think how they might respond or better anticipate a change in maybe caribou distribution.
The findings were published in the most recent issue of the journal PLOS-1. The research is part of the Changing Arctic Ecosystems Initiative, funded by the USGS. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
GCI has completed its purchase of three television stations in Sitka, Juneau, and Ketchikan. The deal means the telecom giant now owns almost every commercial TV station in southeast Alaska. GCI announced Monday that its subsidiary, Denali Media Holdings, had officially closed its purchase of southeast's three CBS affiliates, KTNL in Sitka, KXLJ in Juneau, and KUBD in Ketchikan. According to GCI spokesman David Morris, the company paid about $1 million to buy the three stations from Colorado-based Ketchikan TV. GCI now owns six broadcast TV stations, five of them in Southeast. Morris says that viewers won't see any programming changes in the near term, but down the line, GCI is hoping to roll out services that would allow viewers to watch GCI content on demand on their TV, computer, or phone.
Where everything is moving, at least in this field, is on-the-go type TV services, so that you can see what you want on the device that you want. And this is all part of the integration strategy, at least that we're looking long-term on how to provide that type of thing.
GCI is Alaska's largest cable TV operator and also provides internet, telephone, and cell phone service. The shift into broadcast television over the last 2 years marks a big change for the company.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. To learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
For the second consecutive week, it's wait and see for fishermen who are eager or anxious for the next commercial opening on the Kuskokwim River. KYUK's Ben Matheson reports.
The prospect of commercial fishing again dominated the discussion at a Wednesday meeting of the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group. there haven't been any openings since July 21st, and that's the way many upriver subsistence fishermen with empty freezers want it to stay. Alice Kamaroff from Lower Kalskeg responded to reports from Lower River fishermen bringing in plenty of cohos. She says she hasn't put up any silvers yet.
I wish they wouldn't open commercially unless the silvers reach up here so we can put a lot of fish away too.
Greg Ruzicka from Bethel suggested managers wait until at least the midpoint of the run before an opening.
We want to make sure that there's enough fish to get past insufficient numbers and densities. And because of that increased subsistence need and demand, it's there from the Chinook restrictions.
Theodore Brown spoke in support of an opener and said plenty of fish will make it past his and others' commercial nets.
This lower river area is about like 5 miles from bank to bank. There's a lot of escape and go where the fish could pass through. Even though there's an opener on a commercial fishing day, like 4 hours, we're even lucky to fill like a half a tote of our fish for like 4, 5, 6 hours.
State manager Aaron Potter says the cohos have not yet reached the 25% point of the run at the Bethel test fishery yet. He's waiting for more information before making the call on any commercial opening.
And again, we're so early in the run. When we try to make projections out to what the run could be or will be at the end of the season with such little data, the precision is it's not there yet. So given the needs expressed by the middle and upper river users for the amount of coho they're going to need for subsistence, we're going to take it day by day and look at that projection as each day.
In other action, the group passed a motion in support of a proposed exchange program between different parts of the river. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
An Aniak woman who came across an injured bald eagle earlier this week gave the bird a second chance and brought it to the care of veterinary experts. KYUK's Daisy Eaton has the story.
Around 11 p.m. on Tuesday night, Amanda Holt was riding a four-wheeler with a friend just outside Aniak when she noticed something unusual in their path, a bald eagle.
It started running forward and in front of the four-wheeler because we were stopped, and then its wing was dragging. So I jumped off the four-wheeler and started following it because if his wing was dragging and it wasn't flying away, then I knew he was hurt, so I wanted to help.
At one point, the eagle jumped into the Kuskokwim River and began trying to swim away. She says she went after him.
I didn't even really think about it. I just jumped off the four-wheeler and tried to get him. And then when we had him wrapped in the blanket, I was just like in total awe because he was so much bigger than I thought he would be. And then when I picked him up, he was so much heavier.
But she held on to him the 3 miles back to town. When she got home, the 18-year-old University of Alaska Anchorage student, who's home for the summer, built a plywood pen for the bird with her friend. In the morning, her father contacted Alaska State Trooper Sergeant Nick Zito, who reached out to Bird TLC, a raptor rehabilitation center in Anchorage. Officials there said they'd take the bird. Raven Airlines donated transport from Aniak. In the meantime, the eagle had escaped from the makeshift pen. Holt recaptured the eagle, and after much hissing, she says she put him into a kennel donated by a local dog rescue organization, Canine Comfort. With the eagle secured, Trooper Zito put the bird onto the afternoon flight, which brought it to Guy Runco with Bird TLC in Anchorage.
Well, the eagle looks bright, alert, and responsive. It is up and eating, and it does have a droopy left wing. I'm not sure the extent of that injury to the left wing, but our volunteer veterinarian will be able to figure that out.
Runco says if all goes well, the eagle will be treated and returned to the wild. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
One of the capital city's youngest buskers is raising money this week for a good cause. Elementary school student Sophia Nyland can sometimes be seen playing her violin in downtown Juneau with an open violin case to collect money. This week, all proceeds will go to a Juneau family that lost their home to a fire on Friday. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
It's a drizzly Monday afternoon in downtown Juneau. 8-year-old Sophia Nyland stands in front of the new Heritage Coffee Roasting Company Espresso Bar on South Franklin Street, playing the violin. Like any busker in a city, Sophia gets various reactions from people walking by.
I like playing for the people because the people enjoy music, and some people don't like it. They just walk by and go like, meh, they don't really care.
Sophia has been busking since she was 5. She says the money she gets isn't always for her musical talent.
When I was little, everyone liked because I was so adorable.
She once made $120 in one session.
They weren't looking at me playing the violin, they were just looking at me, like my face.
Sophia started wanting to play the violin when she was 3 years old.
I kept asking my mom, and she said, fine, I'll call the teacher and see.
And she said, you know, she's quite young. They don't start this early. But bring her to a group lesson. She will see what a hard work it is to play violin.
That's Ildi Nylund, Sophia's mother.
Well, I took her to the group lesson, and by the end of the lesson, she convinced the teacher to start to teach her. She's quite headstrong in a good way.
Sometimes Sophia plays downtown for an hour. Sometimes she plays for 15 minutes.
Last time she played about 20 minutes, she made $35.
If you ask Sophia, in the past few summers of playing her violin downtown, she's earned
maybe $1 million. I don't know, but I've been doing this a lot.
Her mom says it's more like $200. Sophia puts a lot of it in the bank to save for college, and sometimes, she says, she gets to spend some of it.
Well, I bought this shirt because it's an Under Armour, and I like going hiking a lot, so I got it.
The shirt is black and hot pink. In her hair, she wears a light blue feather.
I like buying girly stuff because I'm a fashionista.
Sophia plays downtown a few times a month, and usually on the weekend, but this week is different.
On Friday, we were driving by the fire, and I saw smoke, and we looked behind us, and we saw a huge fire. It was like flames everywhere.
The single-family home in the Twin Lakes area was destroyed.
The next day after that, I said to my mom, I want to go play my violin for the people that don't have their house anymore.
Owners Amber and Lucas Schneider have 3 children. Sophia plans on playing for an hour each day this week, and will give everything she earns to the family. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, Ben Matheson and Daisha Eaton in Bethel, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.